Podcast and What's Christmas.
Hello and welcome to episode 28 of If This Is a Podcast and What's Christmas. This week my guest is the awesome, fantastic, incredibly awarded director Frederick Bond. So it was my massive pleasure to have a chat with him here in LA. As I've said on the blog, in case any of you haven't read that, there is a fair bit of ambient noise because we're in the sort of lobby-ish restaurant-y part of a hotel in Santa Monica. So apologies for that. I think if you listen to it, it might be annoying for a couple of minutes, but then you'll just get used to it and it'll be fine. And there's far too many words of deep and lasting wisdom from Frederick to avoid them just because they're couched in the sounds of people clanking crockery, cutlery, and some, I don't know, somewhat questionable music choices. The interesting thing I found out of in delving into Frederick's career is quite how incredibly well he has sustained his quality and his position right at the top of his game. There's a huge amount of competition to be an advertising director, a commercials director, and he's been absolutely brilliant at it ever since he broke on the scene. We talk about some of his ads that he made before coming to the UK and doing work for Skoda and Monster.com. But ever since then, ever since 99, 2000, he's been absolutely brilliant. And, you know, I think Money Supermarket was a very recent example that a lot of you will know. It's been really fantastic. But there's also a couple of great spots for Philips. And I couldn't get the YouTube link to work, but there's also a really good one for LG featuring many Jason Stathams that he did this year and got him a Directors Guild of America nomination as one of the best commercials directors in the world. So Frederick has been brilliant, has continued to be brilliant, and still is brilliant. And for that reason, I want to thank him enormously for taking the time to chat. And I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Thanks very much for making the time to chat. I start a lot of these chats, how and why, well, often I'm asking people how and why they got into advertising, but how and why did you get into directing?
That's a good question. I was obsessed with films as a kid, and my dad had a little editing equipment down in the basement. He was a producer for Swedish television, and was doing a lot of his own editing for his TV shows and stuff. So he always had, you know, action happening in the basement. So it was the mid early 80s where, you know, when VHS and videos started to come into our lives. So I started to punk on movies very soon. So I built up a library of movies and became obsessed with them and had a little, you know, like it was like my stamp collection, notes and my book and actors and directors, and just got obsessed with movies. And eventually I just started to do my own little short stories through the material of the movies, you know. So I just cut my own little shorts through that material. So I didn't do sort of the classic going out with a Super 8 or VHS camera. I took the material that I found in the movies, being fascinated by them, and cut together stories.
And which movies are we talking about here? What were your favorites?
Chuck Norris' Octagon. Chuck Norris' Octagon was one of the highlights.
Not 2001 A Space Odyssey.
No, Chuck Norris, Octagon. I had another favorite movie called The Boy Who Drank Too Much with Ralph Macchio. Which was
so after Crafty Kid, that was?
Yes, okay. way after that. About a ice hockey kid who had an alcoholic father, and he started drinking himself. And it was a really powerful movie that I just kept watching over and over again. I think because maybe, I don't know why, but anyway, so I had that movie, and then I also had My Bodyguard, you know,
Tony Bills. Oh, I've seen it. Yeah, that was a great
movie. Yeah, those were like my, and The World According to Garp, Octagon, World According to Garp, The Boy Who Drank Too Much, those were the four. They were favorite. Cool. And Bus Stop, Marilyn Monroe's Bus Stop. I was obsessed with Bus Stop. Bo, what was his name? Was it Bo Bridges that played the he wasn't Bob Bridges that played the cowboy in could you check it? Bus Stop, Marilyn Monroe.
I'm looking.
Oh, I was obsessed with that actor. He played this hippie Texas cowboy that fell in love with Marilyn Monroe, and his performance was just mesmerizing. So I remember dabbing around with that in the editing suite.
Interesting range of movies. And so after you made all those, you sort of come together, was there a point where you went to film school or you took it to another stage further?
Yeah, I went a short stint to NYU in New York. I was, my next bus stop in the milestones of my film education was I landed in Sydney in 1990. To learn to surf, and I was working in a gay restaurant as a busboy, and the Sydney Film Festival was on, and I got a pass to that festival and just watched every single movie of that. It was sort of my library of movies, and then that experience, 2 weeks of Sydney Film Festival, was just sort of sealed the deal for me. I wanted to work in.
Okay, so you've really got the bug there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's also seeing, at that festival, seeing the movie Rompe Stomper.
Oh, yeah.
And Bad Boy Bobby. It might have been 91, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
And how do you actually begin a sort of career yourself after, so you're surfing in Sydney. What do you do then? Do you go home and go, right, I want to start directing properly?
Well, I was terrible at surfing, so I never got into it. So I had to focus on the movies instead. And I came after Sydney. I went to New York, and I was living on a friend's couch, and he was going to the school of Tisch School of Arts, and he was a super creative guy, and I was just so I hang out with him for two weeks basically, him and his friends, and I was so impressed about his stories about how they had Martin Scorsese in the class telling stories, and all these amazing filmmakers coming in, not really teaching them anything about specific craft making about movies, but just telling stories, you know, about what they were passionate about. And just hearing him and his friends talk about these incredible experiences and how they lit them up just made me feel like that's what I would like to try, you know, going to film school. So I actually applied to Tisch. Couldn't get in, but there was an understudy program called the School of Continuing Education, which was more like a half year thing, which I went into, and that was a school where, because I came from, you know, VHS and video and editing on video and stuff, and this school was really focused on 16mm film, editing on old Steenbecks, so it was sort of my crash course into, you know, the celluloid, and that was amazing. I love that.
Cool. And did you learn more about? So you might have learned about structure and things like that from editing. Did you learn further things about how to actually direct from that course?
You know, I learned mostly from that course. I learned how determined and how tough you have to be. Because the group of people that came to that school was more or less people that had walked down the path of one career or the other and had sort of changed their direction in life and trying to get into films. Everybody was all very, very cutthroat about making it into the film industry. So it was very much about using your elbows trying to get to the director's chair for everyone, you know, because we all started, you know, dabbling with every discipline from cinematography to editing to script writing to directing, but everybody wanted to come to the directing chair. So it's really a race towards the directing chair on every school project that we did. So more than anything, I was kind of shocked about the. Everybody was a little bit more old than I was, and I was in my really early 20s, 21, something like that. And most people were about 27, 28, 30, even up to 40. So it was really their last chance to get into directing. So I learned that more than anything, more than telling a story or anything, I really realized that you have to be very determined to get into this, to start directing.
And so, if you've learned determination and a bit of skill, what did that send you off on the next thing? Is your next part of your path?
I think after that experience, I started to work for the Swedish television. And my cousin actually, my cousin had a small production company in Stockholm, and so I went into to work for him as his assistant and trying to because he was a very determined guy. He had a small production company, very nice commercials, you know, sort of the he was a little bit of the Joel Siedelmeyer of Sweden at that time, and so I really wanted to learn his craft, basically. So I studied him for about a year, and then started work with other directors after that, as their a combination of as their creative assistant and as their editor. So it was a great combination, you know, to be part of the whole process and then take the material and edit it for these directors.
And how did you go from there to actually directing your own stuff? Were you finding your own voice at that stage, you think?
Not really. I think I had a few different directors that I worked with that had different disciplines and different styles. So I wasn't really sure what my style was going to be. But I think I think what I did was that because I loved commercials, always loved commercials and British commercials. Because as a young kid, we always went Christmases to his family friends outside of London, and it was also sort of early 80s, and we didn't have commercials at this time in Sweden. So I saw these incredible short stories that was like 30, 60 seconds, and I got obsessed with them too. So I actually recorded them on VHS and also used them in my editing adventures. So I knew that, you know, I love films, but I also love these commercials, these short form projects. So after I worked with these different directors, I funded my own little spec commercial, a series of spec commercials. I just had half a year of where I just experimented and just did a bunch of these spec commercials. And in that process, just by doing it, I kind of showed it to friends, and one spec commercial we did for Chiquita Bananas, and I thought it was really good because it was it really made a point. It was about a guy who comes into a train and starts eating a banana, and suddenly this hypnotic guitar player playing Jonathan Richman track comes walking up to him in a very hypnotic, sort of mysterious sense, and the guy sort of gets hypnotized for a second, and then realizes that he's about to get raped and runs out of the train. So
by the banana.
Yes.
Okay.
And I thought it was such a brilliant commercial, so I decided to actually, to be honest with you, we didn't have a payoff at that time. So we were thinking.
Thank God.
No, we were thinking that it might be for drunk driving. How we thought of that, I don't know. But anyway, in the editing room, we realized that we can put Chiquita Bananas, because he's eating a Chiquita banana, and it makes sort of a point that you can be, you know, falling into this hypnotic state when you're eating a banana, which everybody does, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
I don't know if everyone gets raped when that happens, but I don't know.
But anyway, so we walked up to, we called Chiquita and said, you can have this commercial for free. We've done a masterpiece for you. Let us show it to you, and you can have it for free and use it on whatever event you want. So we had a meeting with them, and the whole boardroom was silent after the viewing. And the head guy stands up and looks me in the eye and says, "If this commercial comes out anywhere, I'll sue the fucking shit out of you." You know, and then we had to walk out of there. So I knew I was onto something then. You know, I felt like I was definitely onto something. And then we called him back, and ask them if it was okay for us to show it as shots, you know,
the
advertising, monthly or bi-monthly, like video magazine.
Yeah.
So they had seen it or they had heard about it. I can't remember what, but basically they wanted to feature it. So we asked Chiki, like, could you please show it? And surprisingly, this angry guy said yes.
Oh, okay. Now I'm asking.
And after that, we started getting some calls from Italy, from Germany. You know, all these places where sort of weird commercials made sense. So me and my partner, we put on our suits and went down to Milan and started doing commercials in Milan.
So that's how the commercial side started? Professionally?
Yeah, more or less, yeah.
Okay, so I remember some ads that you did got into DNAD involving boxing. Is that right? Were they done in Sweden? I'm not sure.
Yes.
Earlier ones? What were they?
They were... they were for Telia.
Okay.
They were for the telecom company, which there was this amazing agency called, I think it's still around, called Hassan and Partners, which consisted of these guys who didn't give a fuck about clients. They just gave it all to the ideas and the materials. It was a fantastic. I had a friend in Stockholm who basically started. He was believing in me and promoted me in Finland. And she was an agency producer. So, and she said you have to work with Hassan & Partners. So she got me in contact with them. And we did a series of films. And it was the best start of my career I could have, because these guys basically wanted. They knew the value of the shock value and the idea value, and that it was so important to keep the client out of the process. This was, you know, a different time, different country, a different era. So something that would never work today. But these guys, they were really just focusing all their energy on the ideas and these crazy films that they wanted to make. So. I remember at one point I asked them, should we see the client piece of this before we go down the road of this? Fuck the client. They can see it when it's ready. And that was sort of their mantra. You know? So we made a series of films which really made, you know, the Telia thing was one of them. You know, that series of films was one of them. And then we did some stuff for beer as well. And, some clients they lost, of course. Some clients just fucking loved them, and it was a risk taking, and the risk really paid off for them, which was really great for me and super stimulating environment to work in.
Yeah, and I think they got into DNAD, and I'm not sure if that's what was the springboard into England. But when you flick through the DNAD annual and you go, "Who's this guy? And what are these ads?" and you may never have seen them. That was back in the day where you couldn't just share a thing on the internet all the way through the year. You had to wait till the DNAD annual came out. You went, "What the hell is this?"
Yes.
And did that lead to, say, Monster?
No, absolutely. You're right. I think, and then Andy and Rich at Fallon.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Andy and Rich at Fallon saw those ads and. From that, that sort of opened the door in London.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it Skoda first then, or?
I can't remember exactly. Yes, I think it was Skoda, and then Skoda and Monster.
Yeah.
No, Monster was later, Skoda first. Yes.
Yeah, because I remember you were the hot new director at that time. Was this must have been really satisfying for you as a sort of realization of your dream of loving English commercials, and now you're not only making them, you're making them with the best guys. So was that pretty cool?
That was amazing. I mean, I don't know how much I understood what a lucky spot I came into.
Yeah.
It was just really by fluke.
Yeah.
I just hit the nerve with those guys, and they sort of completely, you know, we found a great springboard with those ads, and you know, yes, that was incredible, and I was very lucky to start working with those guys, and they started to write some great stuff that they wanted me to do, and they were super creative, and they are still really creative. of course, and looking back at it now, I kind of a little bit had to rub my eyes to think,
yeah,
about,
amazing.
You know, how lucky I was at that time to really hit into that agency at that time as well.
Because
it was
so
creative.
And there was also a time, I think, in the early 2000s where Scandinavia, particularly Sweden, was getting a really good run, particularly with Mother, in terms of creatives, in terms of directors. There was this whole vibe that what was happening from Sweden and Scandinavia was the things we should be doing. And I'm also thinking that a lot of your ads then were funny. Was that a conscious thing, or is that your personality and you're going, these are the ads I want to do, and humor is a big part of that?
I think it was a time when a lot of ads and a lot of directors and agencies were able to turn things really on their heads. You know, it was a lot of experimentation happening, and they were open for. There was a big. It's really about ideas. You know, ideas came first, and I remember that we always. It was such a focus on how can that end line be as powerful as it possibly can, you know. How can that, you know, in the visual storytelling, how can we surprise as much as possible in that? And everybody was, it felt like the competition was really about overtaking that previous commercial that had that super fantastic end payoff. And we spent so much time always going back and forth. What if we do this? What if we do that? And it was a very creative time. You know, now it's a little different. You know, I don't think it's. I don't want to say it was better before, but I feel like there was a time then in English advertising when it was so ideas driven, much less execution driven. You know, and you could really. You could just bring out your weirdest ideas, and clients may totally go for it, you know.
Yeah, maybe it was like a perfect storm of those factors happening, but also Mother was in the ascendancy at that point as well. And when they came up with whatever the Bachelor Super Noodles face-off thing was,
yeah.
I mean, I remember that came out going, how the fuck did this get made? I mean, first it got written, second Bachelors bought it, third, you know, you're saying that ideas were the main thing, and they were, but the execution of that is hilarious from beginning to end. So maybe there was just all the factors coming together.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think it's, I think that there wasn't the same, people weren't as complacent about, you know, now we're so bombarded with amazing ideas all the time. I don't think we appreciate the amount of great ideas that are around us, you know.
Yeah.
But we didn't have the forums at that time for showing all those ideas, and it was expensive to do them, you know. So I think it was complete luxury to be working with these brilliant ideas and which agencies and clients paid a lot of money for to execute. You know, you had to shoot on film. You had to, you know, there wasn't such thing as just bringing up a 5D. Every commercial cost a fortune. You know, including my spec films. You know, I spent a fortune. I'm still paying off the loan from those spec films. So it was it was a very special time.
And the production company you were with then was Harry Nash. Did they find you and bring you over, or what was there a plan that you were doing for your career then?
You know, the plan I was doing was I had those spec spots on my reel, and I went to London because I wanted to work with British advertising. British advertising was amazing since many years back. But my goal was really to break into London. So I saw, for a week, I saw, I think, 90 production companies, 3 or 4 a day, and just saw every one of them. There was quite a few of them at that time. So you could, and it was quite easy to call up them and say, can I see you guys? I would have a reel, I would love to show you. On a U-matic.
Of course.
On a big U-matic.
Just dragging them around.
Yeah, exactly. So I saw pretty much everyone, and there was like 3 or 4 that I stayed in touch with, because I wanted to see my strategy was to see who stays in touch with me and who keeps the longest interest. You know, so I didn't want to sign with anybody straight away.
I decided to play a little cool and see who. So one by one dropped off, and there was like two or three left in the end that I chose between them. And Harnash, which was the end at that time,
right.
before Harnash, and Julian Lee, which was so passionate. Ringen had just made some fantastic ads the year and 2 years prior, and had really brought the end to the map. And I just loved Kate Nelson and Julia Reed's energy at that time, and Ringen was one of my big heroes, you know. So still is. I was super fortunate to work with, get into that building and start working with those guys.
That's cool. And I guess at that point you are hot enough that all the top creatives are looking. If you particularly got a funny script, that'd be great. But what one of the ones that was interesting around that time was VW Baby, which is probably darker than funny.
Yeah.
And what was the story behind that? Because it is a little bit of a departure from some of the things before, but at the same time, it's quintessentially you. There's a darkness and a humor to it.
You know, but that's interesting you say that, because at that time also there was a hunger for dark commercials. There's been so many glitzy ads. I think that's I'm happy you brought it up, because I feel like that was one of the defining identities of that era, was like, how can this be dark and twisted, as opposed to, you know, how can we really make an impact on the viewer's impression of this brand with, you know, the delicate balance of darkness and humor. You know, that was really the key to that era.
Yeah.
And something that's, you know, I think, I don't feel like there's this, that sort of sensibility and tonality exists really today. Very few brands dare to do something like that today.
It's a bit risky.
But at that time, I feel like a lot of companies knew that was the sweet spot to be.
Yeah.
You know, I think that every few years, every brand tries to follow another ad that's been a success for them,
sure.
You know, and they try to follow that sweet spot in terms of tone and humor and, you know, whatever that tone might be. But that's, for a few years, good few years there, it was like the darkness and cleverness of the ad that sort of, and the surprise of the ad that sort of became the defining thing for brands to try and get hold of.
Absolutely. I think it would also be interesting for people to know, when you think you've got a good script, you send it to a really good director, sometimes they want to do it, sometimes they don't want to do it. Is there method to that choice? Do you talk to a lot of people? Is it just something that hits your gut and you go, that's the one for me? Or is there, I want to go in this direction, I've done too many of these ads, I want to do this ad, and it comes at the right time?
I think most of the time it's trying to find something that you just connect to and that you get excited about. I think it takes a while to get into realizing, for me, what it is that can make this so special. You know, I have to process it quite a few times. You know, do notes, just do some, you know, really go around and think about it. And a lot of times I tell the idea to my family, to my kids, or to my wife, and trying to get into it. And then the next step is, you know, see how the electricity is on the call, you know, with the agency, and see how, you know, how far you can push it. And that can sort of, I think it's all a search for getting in under the skin of it and sort of get authentically excited about it. I think it's always, the whole process for me is always about trying to get into finding when it really hits your nervous system, you know, it really hits your creative spine. And sometimes it happens early, sometimes it happens when you read the script for the first time. Sometimes it actually happens when I'm almost done with the treatment and I start to rewrite it very late in the process. A lot of times it can actually be just that, you know, like you have to write and write and write. You then you suddenly find, that's it. Yeah, that's what I love about this. You know?
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's because I've been doing it for such a long time. You know, it's. I remember the first scripts that you got. You just were so excited just getting the script, and you feel like, oh, I can do something with this. I can do that. But now, you know, you have to be a little bit more, because I think it's important when whatever project you do, you have to be feeling excited about it and be, you know, forget about the fact that it's a job. It's a creative outlet, you know, and that's a spot I'm trying to get into on every job I do. Sometimes, you know, it goes better. Sometimes it goes worse. But I think it's that makes the fun of this job. That makes the job fun, and that makes me keep wanting to do it. You know,
yeah.
I think when you're just doing, it goes with anything we do. When we start to turn on our automatic mechanisms, it's no fun anymore. It's got to find its own life and spontaneity. And that's always the thing for me when I'm trying to get into a project.
Sure, it feels like some of the ones, particularly at the beginning, like Monster and Skoda, probably felt like they were quite tightly written and they had a script and that was it. And then there are other ones where I can't tell if VW Baby was like written very tightly or you brought a lot to it. But something like the Moby Body Rock video, what was even the script for that? Because it feels so loose and yet it's got so much wonderful life to it.
Well, I remember I had a conference call with Moby, and he said, and I asked him, what are your images and pictures when you sort of wrote this song? What does this song stand for you? And he was quiet for a while and said, I just love big tits and ass. And I was so taken aback by that. And I hang up the phone, and for a week I took those comments very seriously. I really loves tits and ass. And then I realized he must have taken the piss out of me. So I realized I have to come up with something original, something that just is me, you know. So I think it took me an hour to write that treatment about a guy who wants to impress Moby. And I think that was basically me trying to impress him. And so, when I see that video now, I feel like he's just said that line. I like to tits and ass. This kid trying to impress him.
Yeah. And you mentioned a bit the writing treatments and stuff, and I guess that's changed enormously over the time you've been in the business, the need to have treatments, and very big treatments, and you're going up against other people, and, you know, it's almost like whoever raises the bar, you know, I'm going to do a rip-o-matic, I'm going to do an animatic, I'm going to do whatever to get the thing. So do you think that's been a positive change in the way directors have had to relate to agencies, or there's been it's more of a difficulty?
I think I think it's a natural progression because the competition is so fierce now. You're always bidding against a bunch of guys, and, you know, established, non-established, you know, there's... So, one level, I think it's good. I think it's good that, you know, the agency has the opportunity to choose the best take. I think, of course, it's frustrating as hell sometimes when you really want and you see that you can do an amazing job and you're trying to convince them at draft after draft or call after call, and, you know, sometimes there's clients who just can't make up their minds either. You don't really know where the hesitation to commit comes from. But I don't want to say that I don't want to say on this podcast that I love making versions of treatment because I do not fucking love do that. But if you sort of when you feel like you've written something, you know, I kind of enjoy when I get into a project and I write it. It's kind of an enjoyable process. You know, it's part of my job.
Yeah.
Of course, I get tired of writing it, especially for the 60-second commercial. I get tired after 10 drafts of this fucking treatment. But, you know, but I think that when you come into a creative sweet spot and you're in the world, you're in a cocoon, and you're in a creative bubble that you love being in, and you know, ideas, because you feel like you hit the sweet spot, ideas just comes to you. That's a very fun place to be in, even when you're writing a treatment, you know. So I want to say half the projects I do is like a single bit project and with relationships I have, and the other half is this hassle of writing treatments. And you know, I don't want to, you know, sometimes it's actually quite nice to go through the whole writing process, and even if it's long and it drains you, it's actually quite a fun race to be in. But don't ask me to do it 10 hours.
So I guess in the sort of early mid-2000s, you are definitely in this upper echelon of global directors to hire for commercials, whether they've got big budgets, whether in different countries or whatever. Did you feel more pressure or no pressure, or did you feel like you had to be careful about what you chose for a path of a career, or was there not that much thought going into it?
You know, I think it still goes, you know, I think on one hand, you know, you really want to overtake the film you just done. You know, I think it's amazing to, I think it's quite fun to try and how can I make the next thing even better? How can I make it even, you know, how can I impress Google even more on this? how can I try to make him watch this? You know, you set your silly goals, you know. Right. I have to set my silly goals to have as a bit of a fire in my ass sometimes, you know. I think it's good to have those, but it's always a pressure. There's nothing, you know. Whenever there's no pressure, I don't think it's not fun. You know? I think with pressure, and with you having to stand on your fucking toes, even if I've done this for a long time, you know, it's always more fun. You know, I think there's no. The easy road is never the fun road, you know.
Yeah.
When there's creatives that challenge you, when you see that they're, you know, they're skeptical to an idea, and you really have to sell it to them, or they have to, or you need to discuss it over and over again. You know, it's a pain, but it's actually leads to something. You know, I'd rather work with really intelligent creatives that ask the intelligent questions and the important questions, rather than not having it at all. Because I think it's a team effort, and with your DP, with your creative team, with your assistant, you know, everybody contributes. You know, and I think it's nice when there's when wherever the pressure is coming from, a client or agency or even just my assistant looking at me with skeptical eyes, is he fucking serious about this? And I have to, you know, having to work things through and feeling the pressure is a good thing.
Yeah. And I think
did that ask you?
It did. But also, I think it's really interesting that all the very best directors, whether it's Tony Kaye or Frank Bajan or Danny Twyman or you, they don't necessarily have a style, although you started off with humour. And when I looked through some of the ads you did, like the three jellyfish is of one completely different style. Adidas Give Me the Ball is another thing without so much humour, but it's sort of a post-production thing. And what for me really sort of cemented you in a slightly different way, but it was a little bit incremental because it was a change, but it made me look at you in a slightly different way, was the JCPenney Aviator ad, because it's a beautifully told story. But it hasn't got the craziness of Bachelor's Super Noodles or anything like that. But it's really, really well done as almost like a short film. And I don't know if there was anything deliberate happening in that way. But I think the way that you then were perceived as a director was like Frederick can do anything at that stage. And was that a satisfying place to be in? Did you feel the scripts were changing in that way?
I do think that there was that time when people got a little bit more, complacent about the shock effect of a lot of ads, and because I think we had a good run there with 6-7 years where you know, there was this, the as you say, the more, yeah, the crazy ads, you know, and the sort of, and the darker ones. I think that was a shift there around when also when sort of Sony Balls came out. And,
oh yeah, it was, you know, a bit nicer.
Yeah, there was a little bit more of a sort of softer folkloric value that started to come into the. And I think all of us directed with sort of a little feeling like, okay, that's, you know, the dark, crazy shit is kind of, you know, a little bit, we're a little bit tired of that right now. Let's go for something that feels a bit more gentler and connects on a more soulful level. You know? And I think that's. It's funny, like we talked about earlier, you know, it feels like that's something that's the ad industry and the film industry, probably more, the trends are more clear in ads. So I think
Because they can be a bit more responsive, I think, because films take 3 years.
Absolutely.
Ads can be right out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting that there's a context that changes your work, or probably the work of all the directors then. You're going, we're in the world of Ponder Gruer now, it's all a bit nicer and whatever, rather than... Because this is the first time I'm really thinking back to that era where you kind of almost had to be dark and crazy in the early thing. And talking about that, just not wanting to gloss past it, what was the script for Jellyfish like?
What was the script for Jellyfish like? That was a very brief... That was probably the shortest script I've ever seen, because they really wanted a director to come on and do their thing. I think it said something like, I remember talking about this a few years ago actually, and it was like 2 or 3 lines saying about, you know, two guys find a jellyfish in the desert, and they didn't start dancing with it. They find a jellyfish and then rescue it or something, you know, bring it back home or something like that. But basically, the script was something like that. But I don't know if the creative directors or writers listen to me now, so don't kill me if I'm wrong about this, but I do feel like it was a very brief, and they're really, you know, but I think that's also a very brave thing to do. I think how can you send in a script to a client with that sort of confidence and say, you know, let this person take it on? I don't think it's a sign of not having worked it through and given it a lot of thought. I think it's a sign of actually being extremely confident and relying on something that's on a concept that they know a director has to. Because a lot of scripts can be overwritten,
and
they then have to pare down, and the client fall in love with certain elements, and it's like, you know, it's a mess to undo a lot of ideas in a script. You know, so sometimes when you write a treatment, and you are forced to take out a bunch of ideas that the client might have fallen in love with, but that film is going to be 5 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's not going to be 30 seconds. You know, they go, well, we'll need that back in. So anyway, so I think that's a short script is often a sign of some really, you know, brave, especially nowadays.
Yeah.
Especially nowadays. Some, you know, a really good relationship with the client, or that the result of, you know, creatives and knows that it's the value of having it over to a director who would make a spin on it.
Yeah, and no one just keep on and on about the spot, but when someone's making a decision to have Japanese cowboys as the characters in that, you know, there's so much freedom. You can go, is it Japanese cowboys? Is it Glaswegian milkmaids? Is it whatever? And so what I think is fascinating is that you've got that enormous amount of freedom, but for me, the Japanese cowboys work perfectly, but who says they work perfectly? Is that your decision? Is that a collaboration? Do we all go, yeah, Japanese cowboys, that's cool?
That really annoys me. It really annoys me. I want to say it was all my idea.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
I'm sure.
but I can't take the claim for that. It could, I mean, it's, I feel like the whole, because the whole campaign was sort of Asian-ish with the sherry and, you know, it was an Asian vibe. I want to say that that was something that was important for the client and for the, yeah, because it was a Hong Kong, it was a Hong Kong thing, and I think it was,
One of the other sports guys, I interviewed Neil Dawson for an episode, maybe 10 episodes ago, and he's still got a huge amount of heart for the Phillips Epilator spot and still talks to Karis, and they meet up when they're in LA. Again, that's got a lot of heart and soul feeling as well. It's not a funny ad, but it's really charming. And do you feel like that was, were you taking that on for a specific reason that was just beyond the script because it was doing something, you know, in society as well?
I think it was. I think a large part of that was the fact that Neil and his crew and his team really wanted to make a soulful, you know. Wanted to explore this transgender culture and it felt very fresh, you know, the idea to have this racer being a central part of this transgender woman's life, and I think Neil and his crew were very specifically not sensationalist about it, you know. They really wanted to bring out the person behind it, because it could be very cheesy if you know whatever you think of the ad or not. But I thought we hit a quite sweet spot there with really getting to know Karis a bit, and you know, in the short amount of time that we had with her in the spot. But so yeah, again, I think that was a brilliant idea from the creatives to begin with, and that one in particular, I want to say I don't know how much I contributed as in terms of vision. I think it was very much a team effort and more sort of documentary, observant way of approaching the project. You know, a lot of times that's a decision, you know, a mindset you have to decide to go into early on in the project when you talk to the creatives and about the project. Is this something where I really, you know, put a directorial stamp, my directorial stamp on it? I can bring on a world, or is it something where it takes a little bit more of a step back and more gentle and more following this wind, that sort of this whole thing, and that was definitely the case with that project. You know, we didn't want, it was important not to force too much into that.
Sure. So in the earlier 2000s, you made that really great short film Mood. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but that was really nice.
Thank you.
Was there a plan to go into feature films at that point? Was that part of it, or was it just something you wanted to make?
I think it's always to do something longer and to do something that you have a world that you can stay a little bit longer in. I think that one was just sort of an idea that I just felt like a lot of that was an idea that I just felt I had to do, you know. So it was a lot of times these ideas grabs hold of you and you can't stop thinking about them, and that's when you have to do something about it. And that was this idea about this bad mood traveling from person to person, like an illness, transmitting from person to person. I just love that as a concept. And it wasn't necessarily to make a movie out of it. It was more an idea that I just wanted to explore and see how it could play in a long form.
Sure. And any sort of transition or trying to make feature films, it feels like there's not a lot of consistency. I've seen bad advertising directors make it. I've seen really good advertising directors not make it. Is there something about the process of getting into that world which is incredibly tricky or very different, or how does it work for you? Because you made your movie, was it
2013.
So what was the process leading up to that, and how would you describe it?
I want to say I was really hungry to do something longer. I wanted to, you know, so for years I was trying to figure out which project that would be
you know, it was everything from writing myself to engaging in other people's scripts to, and then I just, this script came, was sent to me by the producers and just felt like it had so many different challenges with it. You know, it was like five movies in one. And I was just so curious about, you know, that was one of the things about that project, is that I really wanted to see how can I blend all these tones together? How can I make this love story be sort of the bridge between these extremes of you know, this sort of graduate-like story of this coming-of-age, story, mixed with this thriller, mixed with with this story about a young man going through the grief of his mom's death. It was just so many interesting components, you know. Sure, in the end result, I feel like there was a lot to digest, and we all knew it was a risky project, you know, but it was such a fantastic creative process to go through that I, you know, either you love it or you hate it, you know. The movie, you know, hit really strong with certain people and hit very badly with other people. You have to be in the right mindset to see the movie. I think it's not a perfect movie by any sense, but there's stuff I really love about it, you know, and I'm very proud of. And of course, it's like, you want the world to see, you know, you pour your guts into something and you really work your ass off for a few years to make it. So of course you want as many people to appreciate it and see it. But so it was a letdown that it wasn't the big success that we all wanted it to be, you know, and this, you know, sort of a, I think maybe we had our heads too up, all of us had our heads too high up in the sky and think that this was going to be, you know, a sort of creative milestone, because it had so many incredible things about it, and the script was very hyped up, and, you know, which never helps a project, by the way. I learned that for sure. But you know, in the end of the day, there's certain parts of it that I'm really proud of, and others, other parts that I would definitely do differently, you know, next time.
Yeah, and was there, because you're making a conscious decision to be sort of out of the loop advertising wise for a few years at that point. So, is that something that's an easy balance to do, or are you going like, oh, I'm missing out on some of these great advertising scripts, but I've got to just mark out these 3 years and not do anything? How does that work for you as a director and decision you're making?
I think with everything you do, you just have to sort of shut down a little bit, put your blinders on, and that's what I did with the movie, at least, just really shut everything down, all the noise out, and not be, and yeah, I have to do that also when I'm in the middle of a commercial, you know.
Yeah.
You can't be too distracted on what's going on and, you know, other requests or anything like that. So I think it's important to that was a big part of going into Charlie Country, was just to shut everything off and just be focused on that. I didn't do that actually, but a lot of my director friends who goes into their movies writes an email when they go into prep saying, sorry, I won't be able to answer your emails or answer your phone calls. I'm going into the bubble, and see you on the other side in 2 years. And that, I think that's pretty clever way to do it. But then you said, I'll do that for the next one for sure, because there was a lot of people that sort of wondered why I didn't return their calls or their emails for a while. But that's a good mindset to do as well. Good for your mindset just to make a clear mark for yourself.
Yeah. Without wanting to blow too much smoke up your ass, why is that a phrase? Why is blowing smoke up someone's ass a good thing? Let's not go into that. But you just had one of your best years as a director.
Yeah.
Obviously quite a long time after you started, you had a DGA nomination, you made some really, really fantastic work.
Oh yeah.
So is there a secret to the longevity and to keeping yourself fresh and present to those kind of things?
I think it's just making sure that you keep being passionate about the project you do. Because I think it's,
it's the best job in the world when you do things that you love and you work with creative people that you love and you surround yourself with people. You know, but it can be the, if it becomes a factory store, then it's the worst job in the world.
Yeah.
I think it's just, you just got to make sure that you're keeping the creative juices up and you find it exciting to go into the editing room and see what happened, what, you know, and not seeing it as just another commercial. That to me is the key. This is not a commercial. This is like a short story. It's okay. It has a branded message to deliver, but it's really a story and connect with it on a sort of personal level.
Yeah, and I think what I found kind of interesting is we'd been in America for a couple of years, and then we came back last sort of winter, and I picked up the campaign sort of thing of the year thing, and I hadn't seen the Money Supermarket ad at that point, and I saw it, and I loved it, and my kids loved it, and I thought it was amazing, and I didn't realize what a huge thing it was. Was it really satisfying for that to have been so picked up by the public? And so
I love that. No, yeah, no, of course, yes, it's satisfying to see it, you know, get good reactions to things, of course, and that gives you more air to go further with the next one, and, you know, push more energy into and try new ideas into, or take risks with something. It all helps with that, you know. But I think you, at the end of the day, I think you can also get you can get a little complacent and addicted to that too. So I think you have to be a little bit, you know, not saying that it happens all the time, but you know, I think that directors' lives goes up and down, you know. I think the only thing you can do is just keep working hard and just stay focused on your job. Somebody wise friend of mine said, you know, don't focus on anything else but just do the best possible job you can ever do, and your career will live forever. You know, that's so true. You don't have to, don't focus on the money, don't focus on, you know, just focus on, you might not be the richest guy, but you will have a lot to give it to
me. Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And that kind of makes the job fun too. It's an easy recipe to make your job fun and you want to stay at it. And I think that's not having said that, you know, it's just being a breeze through all these years, you know. You go down and you get depressed about the work you do, and you don't believe in yourself. And then suddenly, what the fuck happened there? They like that? Okay, great, I'm up again. You know, and then so it goes up and down, of course. But I think not losing sight of why you actually did this, or what makes you tick for the world you're in, I think it's important to keep track of. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I think it's, you know, everybody has their methods, and what works for them, you know, that's what works for me. Some guys are great at combining, you know, doing tons and tons of jobs and just make them brilliant each time, and you know, everybody has their balance and their set of rules that works for them. So I think that's the simplicity of just making each commercial count as is the last one and have as fun as possible. That to me is the worst thing.
Cool. Even though I think that would be a really, really good note to end on, I just wanted to ask
okay.
you one more question. That's really what's next. I mean, do you have a plan for how you want to progress the next stage of your career? Are there movies or short films you want to make?
Well, I was just part of a big, because I was very excited. On Monday, I was very excited because I had a huge pitch on a movie at Sony, and I was in the last sort of race for it, and I lost it on Tuesday.
Okay.
So I was very depressed, but then 2 hours later I got confirmed on this amazing Heineken campaign. So, you know, it goes up and down. So we're doing, yes, I want to only keep doing ads that I love and pursuing movies that I love as well. You know, so you know, it's all a mixed bag, and just keep the creative juices flowing. You know.
Great. Well, huge thanks for making time to have a chat. And I think a lot of the things you said apply to directors, but I think it apply to all sorts of creative people, whether in advertising or outside. I think, you know, the way you've gone about building your career, but also keeping it sustained at that top level is a huge lesson for a lot of people.
Thank
so
you.
Thanks a lot, Frederick.
Awesome. Pleasure speaking to you.
Thank you. You too. Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks.